But even a retarded ape, like the person currently occupying the the Oval Office of the White House, even he recoiled at the images flashing across the computer screen of bombing bridges with those people surrounding them. Jared Kushner, he looks like he's been on puberty blockers for the last 30 years. It's going to be a big problem for Trump with regard to Netanyahu. Because, the first instinct of everybody is to blame somebody else. Yeah, Israel tipped the balance, but that the U.S. had no interest? The U.S. that had Iran in its crosshairs since 1979? What Tucker Carlson tweeted to Trump? And that was kind of touching. Marco Rubio, when he goes to the toilet, he carries his GPS to find his anal cavity.
I mean, there's so many questions here. Whether Redeem exists, why would they fabricate these quotes?
What is Netanyahu? Yes, in his youth, he was probably smart. I'm not going to take that away from him. But now he's just a talented used car salesman. I say to the Gulf states, cry me a river. I don't believe it's going to happen again. Whatever comes of these negotiations, the war is over. If you walk in the middle of the road, you'll be hit by traffic in both directions.
That's a good joke. That's a good one. Clap. Hi, good day. Welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. I'm your host, Ashfaq Karim, and joining me today again is Norman Finkelstein. Norman, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Norman, you're joining us today, just the morning after Iran and the US, or Trump and Iran, have agreed to a ceasefire brokered by Pakistan. What's your read on the ceasefire?
Well, at first glance, it didn't seem to me to be, not that I really like to calculate in these terms, but it didn't seem to me to be a victory for Iran. It clearly was not a victory for the United States. If you look at the various and goals or objectives of Trump over the past 40 days, he certainly did say at a certain point that he was not going to settle for less than unconditional surrender. He clearly did not get that. He did certainly suggest that he wanted regime change. He didn't get that. He clearly suggested that he hoped or expected to disarm Iran. That didn't happen. So it can be said with certainty, Trump did not achieve any of his avowed aims. On the other hand, Iran did say that it would not open the Straits of Hormuz until it was certain that there wouldn't be a renewed attack in a few weeks after Israel and the United States recouped or prepared for a next round, and that they wouldn't open the Straits of Hormuz in exchange for a ceasefire. They wanted a robust final settlement, which they clearly did not get. It was said frequently, all Iran has to do to win is not to lose, and they did not lose. So at that level, there is an argument to be made that they won. Now, it is clear, and I said so last night when I was interviewed, that the critical role in achieving this ceasefire was China. And China is obviously heavily dependent on international trade and also on oil from the Gulf. And it also has allies among the Gulf states. China really has no enemies. Well, you could say in its immediate environs, there's tension between it and Japan and it and Taiwan and it and Vietnam. But generally, China is just in it for the money. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is for philosophers to debate. But China has no dog in military conflict. Quite the contrary. China knows that it's an economic powerhouse, the global economic powerhouse, and if military type conflicts are in abeyance, it's going to win battle for global dominance. So it doesn't want fighting. And they are correct, in my opinion, when they say the actions of Trump, this kind of brutal resort to force, they're the death pangs of a dying empire. When you have no other tools in the shed except violent force, it means you're on the decline. And so the Chinese recognize that these are kinds of tantrums being thrown by a dying global, superpower on the world's globe. It's in a state of decline, and the constant resort to force, the crudeness with which it's being wielded, is an index of its decline. Now, China apparently pressured Iran to accept the deal. I can't say, it's not as if the Iranians are omniscient or always exercise perfect diplomatic skill. Maybe the Chinese were right to put a halt to it before we crossed the precipice and the whole world fell into an abyss. So we have to factor in the Chinese intervention. All those who say, oh, I predicted this, I knew it would happen, it's just complete nonsense. I'm of the Tolstoy school. There are so many unpredictable factors when it comes to a war that you really cannot predict the outcome. And in this case, how many commentators predicted that China would enter the scene and basically tell Iran, you have to sign on? Nobody predicted that. It's one of those factors that you can't know with any kind of certainty, which is why I think, as I said, Tolstoy was right. So, having said that, I think there are a few important points to make. Number one, I don't believe it's going to happen again. Whatever comes of these negotiations, the war is over. And let me try to explain why. We have now an unusual situation in American history. We have a largely personalized presidency. Trump is aware of U.S. national interests, and the U.S. has always wanted to rid itself of the Islamic Republic of Iran. That goes back to 1979. That's why the U.S. supported the Iraqis during the war in 1980 to 88. And that's why it imposed from a long time back brutal sanctions on Iran and so on and so forth. That has been a common theme. There was a certain let up with the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, but it didn't last very long. And when the Biden administration had an opportunity to reverse Trump and go back to the JCPOA, Biden and Blinken, the Secretary of State, opposed it. So with the exception of a relatively small period of time, it's been a consistent U.S. national interest as defined by the ruling elites to rid itself of the Iranian menace. So when Trump launched the attack on Iran in cahoots or colluding with Israel, he wasn't acting against the U.S. national interest and being manipulated, tricked, duped by Israel. That's so silly. You have to have completely blinded yourself to 30 years of history to forget that ridding the Middle East of Iran has always been defined by ruling elites as a national interest. And I can go through the record, but I won't do so unless you ask me. In fact, if you go back and look at 2003, the attack on Iran, the attack on Iraq. Iraq was supposed to be a stepping stone to Iran. The only difference between the U.S. and Israel at that point was whether Iran would be first, that was Israel's preference, or Iran would be last after Iraq and Syria, that was the U.S. preference. But there was complete agreement that Iran had to go. There was all the same talk about mad mullahs in 2003, all the same talk about regime change. And this was not Israeli orchestrated. This was two very homegrown Americans. It was Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. They weren't acting at the behest of Israel. They were acting at the behest of what they understood to be U.S. national interests. Now, I began that excursus by saying something is different about the Trump presidency. It's highly personalized. It's true, the background music is the national interest. And Trump is a member of the ruling elite. He is part of that class. So his instincts are always in a harmony with the national interest. But in general, but in the particular moment, he's acting on his very personalized interest. We've not really had a president like that. U.S. presidents in general have been very responsible in the sense of responsible to their responsibility to the ruling elite. You could say Clinton, okay, he had some silly sideshow, but Clinton never lost sight of the U.S. national interest. Carter was preternatural in his commitment to that national interest. Obama had no real interest in politics, neither did George Bush Jr. They had no real interest in politics, but they appointed people in the senior positions who were very sensitive and cognizant of the U.S. national interest. That's not Trump. Trump went into this war because he thought it would be another moment, and maybe a shining moment, of grandeur for him. It was very personalized. He had those seeming victories in Gaza where he quote-unquote ended the war, thought he would win the Nobel Prize for it, and then the immaculate coup in Venezuela. So now he was suffering from a certain, you might call it, excess of hubris. And then he had two major defeats. He had the defeats in Greenland, where he said he's taking Greenland, no question about it, no discussion, no debate, and it ended up being a debacle. And then he had the defeat in Minnesota domestically, when he said ICE was going to take over. It didn't. He had to leave. He had to retreat in Minnesota. So after those two defeats, he wanted to restore his grandeur. It was a very personal, the decision to go into Iran, even though it wasn't contrary to U.S. national interests, it was not, it was still a very personalized decision. Trump, having been told by the Israelis it would be a cakewalk, Iran was on the precipice, all it needed was a little jolt, and it would fall over. He believed it. And there the Israelis did play, in my opinion, a critical role, because Trump assembled an administration of sub-mediocre yes-men. But the thing is, he knew they were sub-mediocre yes-men. In fact, that's why he chose them. And so he didn't trust their judgment. He didn't defer to them. That was unusual. Now, Cheney and Rumsfeld did trust their judgment and did ignore others, but that's because they had very good judgment. They were wrong in the case of Iraq, but in general, they were extremely competent, very smart, and very conscientious in their service to the national interest as they perceived it. Trump just had sub-mediocre yes-men, and so he deferred to the Israeli judgment. The Israelis, you might say, they filled the informational void. The informational void that Trump himself had created when he appointed people like Hegseth and Rubio and ambassadors like Witkoff and Kushner. And so I do believe the Israelis tipped the balance. They tipped the balance by telling Trump that he would emerge a triumphant figure like Caesar or Napoleon. Trump believed it. And they tipped the balance when they told him it would be a cakewalk. Exactly, by the way, what Rumsfeld and Cheney thought in 2003, that it would be a cakewalk. So my opinion is, because it's so personalized, Trump, the national interest is there, but it's not his priority. He won't do it again. It was a disaster. It's exactly what happened with Greenland. Once Greenland did not turn out the way he hoped, it was forgotten. How many people talk about Greenland now? Now, do you remember it was in the top of the news for weeks? It was just, he just walks away. He doesn't care. He's basically an agent of chaos. He will find another place to create chaos because, of course, as a megalomaniac, he loves the headlines. So loves to be in the limelight. So he will just, in my opinion, it didn't turn out as he thought it would, just like Greenland didn't. He'll just walk away and forget about it. Now, a responsible statesperson would not do that because they would reckon it a loss for the U.S. national interest. They would. A responsible statesperson would think many times about a decision like that. I don't believe he thinks twice about it because he doesn't have the national interest first in his mind. It turned into a disaster. He knew he had to end it some way. And now, in typical Trump fashion, I believe he's just going to walk away. Some people say, I should say, it's going to be a big problem for Trump with regard to Netanyahu. Because, you know, the first instinct of everybody is to blame somebody else. And in his mind, Netanyahu misled him. Netanyahu was wrong. He misled him. You said it was going to be a cakewalk. You said Iran was going to be on the brink. You said the people were going to rise up. You said you had all your agents all over Iran ready for a popular insurrection. Well, that didn't happen. Now, I'll tell you the truth. I didn't know which way it would go with the population. I spoke to many people who know Iran like the back of their hand. I mean, like the back of their hand. There were two possibilities. One possibility was the Venezuela possibility. The leader leaves, the people don't care. Maduro is very unpopular. He was, you have to be honest about that. The second possibility was it was going to be the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had just gone through a very brutal period of the collectivization, tens of millions of people were killed, then the purge trials in the 1930s. And for those of your listeners who don't know the history, when Nazi Germany invaded Russia, the first months it was a cakewalk. They swept into Russia, disaster for the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union, the Germans made one big mistake. They wanted what was called living space in Russia, Lebensraum. And living space means you have to get rid of the population that lives there. And so they embarked on a war of extermination. And the ex war of extermination proved to be a disaster for Hitler because, notwithstanding the brutality of Stalin's regime, notwithstanding the collectivization, the purge trials, which eliminated the entire military leadership and political leadership in the Soviet Union, the people embraced the quote unquote great patriotic war, and they defeated pretty much on their own. Forget about the nonsense you read in the West. Pretty much on their own, they defeated the Nazi army. That was a second possibility. And the second possibility is what happened. The more Trump turned it into a war of extermination, like the Nazis did with Russia, the more they turned it into destroy the civilization, so on, so the people rallied. It was the Soviet Union's great patriotic war a second time. And so the expectations, remember the famous line by Trump, not that he has any famous line because he's a retarded ape, but we'll just quote him. He said, "It's your country, rise up and take it." Well, that's not what happened. They rallied around Iran, the civilization. So, the famous line by Shakespeare in Hamlet, what a piece of work is man. There are moments of inhumanity, there are moments of sublimity, sublimeness, of genuine human courage and character. And the scenes of the Iranians en masse surrounding their bridges, the bridges of their civilization, surrounding the power plants, the sources, the energy sources of their civilization. I received an email today from a friend in Iran. He's been chronicling for me what's happening because I want to get a sense. And he talked about how he, with his two grandchildren, were out by a bridge in the freezing cold, all ready to die. It's deeply moving. It reaches the deepest recesses of the soul and the spirit to see that. It rises way, way, way above the mad mullahs and all of that stuff. It's about something so much more profound. Same thing happened if you read Tolstoy's War and Peace about the war against Napoleon. And you see how these moments, they reveal something truly profound and sublime about the human spirit. They didn't predict that. What is Netanyahu? Yes, in his youth he was probably smart. I'm not going to take that away from him. But now he's just a talented used car salesman. If you look at him, his face, he's so hollowed out. And his physical stature has shrunk. Well, that comes with age, but with him, it's actually more dramatic. He's, if you know the play, Death of a Salesman, he's not like Willie Loman, the salesman. He's such a pitiful, I don't pity him, but he's such a pitiful, pathetic sight. The used car salesman holding up his diagrams from a Looney Tunes cartoon. It did come as a shock to them. It did. I do believe, I could be wrong for sure, but even a retarded ape, like the person currently occupying the Oval Office of the White House, even he recoiled at the images flashing across the computer screen of bombing bridges with those people surrounding them. As they say, not a good photo op. So I think there's going to be a bit of a falling out between Trump and Netanyahu, as in, what the F did you tell me? You said all the people would rise up. You told me your agents were everywhere. You told me this and you told me that, you know, so he'll be pissed for sure. As to the, I know that some people are harping on the fact that Trump agrees to negotiate according to Iran's 10-point peace plan. I consider that meaningless. Do you think this man is able to even read the peace plan? No, I'm serious. He has no mental discipline to read 10 points. And here's the second thing. You think he cares? Can anyone be so stupid, so naive as to believe he even cares about a peace plan? Like his board of peace? He just creates these instruments for the spectacle and the grandeur. He doesn't care about the details. He's a 78-year-old man. His term of office will be over in 3 years. His main interests are money and golf, and of course, women. Peace plans, boards of peace, and then these idiotic, these moronic pundits pondering these things as if they have any consequence whatsoever. When it comes to President Trump, if you were to say to me a Jimmy Carter, I'd say, yeah, he does care. Jimmy Carter was a micromanager. He cared. I read volumes of his term of office, his presidential papers. He would fill in the margins the most minute details on memoranda that he was sent. He would say, but check this, and I'm not sure if you read the most minute details. Believe me, there are topics I know very well, and I was shocked at his degree of knowledge of the details. Same thing with Clinton. It was said, I believe it. Clinton said, by the end of the negotiations at Camp David in 2001 being Taba, he said, I knew every street in Jerusalem. I believe that's true. But Trump? No. That's not going to happen. So people who think it's a victory that Trump said he would consider Iran's 10-point peace plan, I just think it's ridiculous. The whole thing, Trump counts on one thing, which is probably true. The news cycle passes so quickly. All he has to do is create a new scene of chaos, and the whole thing will be forgotten. It will. Does anyone even remember Minnesota? With Vice and ice. Does anybody even remember it? How many people remember Greenland? He counts on that because he figures most people's attention span is about the same as mine. That's what you get from surfing on the web too much. You reduce and reduce and reduce and reduce your attention span. So I think he'll probably walk away. Try to forget about it, change the subject, you know. Another day, another scene of chaos. That's Trump. If you read the New York Times now, the homepage, I would say 70% of the articles are Trump this, Trump that, Trump this, Trump that, Trump this, Trump that. And that's all he cares about. He loves the attention, the fact that the whole world fears him. What will Donald Trump do? Do you know the feeling of power he experienced two nights ago? But in this case, it was the sense of power, but also the sense of dread. He got himself into a mess. And there I think that the Israelis had a hand. The Israelis, what they did was they tipped the balance. That Trump didn't know whether to do it or not, because he doesn't know anything about anything except golf, money, and the third thing. He knows nothing about anything. And he didn't trust his advisors, because he knew they were complete. You know, Marco Rubio, when he goes to the toilet, he carries his GPS to find his anal cavity. He's a complete zero. I mean, I don't like them, but Hillary Clinton was highly competent. Anthony Blinken, very competent. Rubio, and then Hegseth, you don't know if he's what he calls himself, the Secretary of War, the Secretary of Peace, Secretary of Defense, the original name of the title, or Secretary of Hair Gel. I'm inclined to the third. If you look at his female appointments, Pam Bondi, Kristi Noem, Carolyn Leavitt, the press secretary, they all look like their last job was at Hooters. And then Jared Kushner, he looks like he's been on puberty blockers for the last 30 years. I mean, somebody ought to tell Jared, it's time to get rid of the blockers and grow some facial hair. His face looks like a porcelain vase. It's very strange. And Witkoff, okay, if I'm playing golf and I have to decide whether to use a wood or an iron, Witkoff's advice would be quite useful. But otherwise, no. And he knew it. I mean, Trump is smart enough to know that he appointed idiots. And so he deferred to the Israelis. Let me tell you, Rumsfeld and Cheney would never defer to the Israelis. They know the Israelis have their own agenda. It's not our agenda. And we're not taking anything from them. You know, we're not taking any intelligence information, which is all cooked because it's the Israelis. And we're not listening to what they have to say. But Trump, because of his administration, the administration he created, there was an informational vacuum. And the Israelis filled it. There's a simple test to prove my point. This test is this. There's this informational vacuum. We all agree on that. He turns to the Israelis and he says, should I attack Iran? If the Israelis had said, let's say Netanyahu, don't do it. It's going to be a disaster. So many unpredictable factors. Stay away. It could turn into a debacle. I have no doubt Trump wouldn't have done it. He would not have done it. The Israelis tipped the balance. It's not as if Iran neutering Iran wouldn't have been celebrated. Of course it would have been celebrated. If Trump had succeeded, wouldn't the entire ruling elite say this is a huge victory to have rid the Middle East of the mad mullahs? Wouldn't they have all said that? So of course it was in the U.S. national interest as perceived by the U.S. ruling elites. But it is true that the Israelis tipped the balance this time, in my opinion. And it turned into a disaster.
Okay. Thanks, Norman. Now, you mentioned the Israelis tipping the balance. The Israelis have also, I think from their perspective, they've devastated once more of southern Lebanon. I think that's quite important for them. It's obviously very horrific for the people of southern Lebanon. The Israeli instinct to still try to weaken Iran and create more chaos in the region will still be there, even though, as you mentioned, Trump, for him, it's very personal. And so because of this loss, he may retreat. How do you see those two things working out? So both know the devastation of southern Lebanon, and then also how is the Israeli instinct to want to derail the ceasefire and create more chaos? How is that going to be curbed, given what you said?
Okay. We have to remember how the situation in Lebanon, how it began and how it unfolded. So let's start with the basic facts. Iran was the victim of probably the most brazen, flagrant, egregious breach of the UN Charter in modern history. The war of aggression that was launched against it. There's no comparison, in my opinion. Even before the UN Charter, you take the Nazis in 1939 when they invaded Poland. They fabricated a border incident. It was a fake, but they knew they had to have some justification for invading Poland. You had to have some sort of justification. Even the Nazis recognized that fact. It was a fabricated border incident, but, the expression hypocrisy is the compliment that vice pays to virtue. And here, there's a variation of it. They recognize that they had to have some pretext to justify the attack. When the U.S. Increased its involvement in the war in Vietnam with ground troops, President Johnson, LBJ, as he was called, Lyndon Baines Johnson, he fabricated the Gulf of Tonkin incident. You are too young to remember it. But that was a turning point in the war. The Gulf of Tonkin, it was claimed that a North Vietnamese vessel had attacked an American vessel. Turned out to be false. But that commenced a major escalation in the U.S. war in Vietnam. It was called, for the sake of your listeners, those who are interested, it was called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which signaled a major escalation in the war. They needed a pretext. There was no pretext in the case of Iran, none. It was so brazen, so flagrant, so egregious, the assault on Iran. At that point, there was no longer any laws of war. They had gone. I had already written in November 2025, I had already written that when the UN Security Council handed Donald J. Trump the deed to Gaza, that's what it did. Very few people know it, because they haven't read Resolution 2803. UN Security Council Resolution 2803 gave the deed of Gaza to Donald J. Trump, a retarded ape. They gave him the deed to Gaza. At that point, I wrote, the UN is now a rotting corpse. when the U.S. and Israel invaded, I should say, U.S. and Israel launched a war of aggression against Iran. If you read the Security Council, the emergency hearings, they were breathtaking. If you read those, if you listened to those hearings, as I did, I didn't read them yet. If you listened to them, it was as if Iran was the aggressor. It was as if Iran was the aggressor. The Russian representative, and I don't always quote the Russians, but in this case, the Russian said, it's as if the British and the French are living in a parallel universe. He described it as going back to Alice in Wonderland, the sequel book was called, it was as if through the looking glass. It was completely insane. You're blaming Iran? This was the most brazen, flagrant, egregious breach of the UN Charter in modern history, even preceding the Charter. And you're blaming Iran? At that point, there was no longer a rule of law. We had returned to what the philosophers in the 19th century called, we had returned to the state of nature, where everybody is responsible only to themselves to preserve their life against what John Locke called the wild beasts, the wild beasts. And Iran was now attacked by two wild beasts, unconstrained by law, unconstrained by any sense of morality, two wild beasts. Now, in that situation, Iran, of course, had the right of self-defense. That isn't even a matter of dispute by rational individuals. And also, Hezbollah, the party of God, had every right, and you might argue, every responsibility to come to the defense of Iran, which was being assaulted by two wild beasts. Of course, they had that right to come to Iran's defense. In the late 1990s, there was this whole doctrine called R2P, responsibility to protect. It was this liberal doctrine. And basically, it meant when international institutions failed in their responsibility to defend countries from genocide, aggression, and so forth, it's the responsibility of others, individual countries, to protect. Well, that's what the party of God, the Hezbollah, did. It fulfilled its responsibility to protect the civilized country of Iran against the wild beasts that were assaulting it. However, it's not really however, it's an in addition. I don't want to say however, that right, and I would say responsibility to come to Iran's defense against the wild beasts, that to me is plain as day. But there is the political consideration. If you do so, Lebanon was going to be destroyed. And they knew it. It was going to be destroyed. During the Israeli genocide in Gaza, Syed Nasrallah, the Secretary General of the Hezbollah, he desperately tried to carve out a middle path. He wanted to defend, and I believe it was sincere. It was not just strategic calculation. He wanted to defend the people of Gaza from the genocidal assault. But he knew if he went just a little bit too far, Lebanon would be leveled. He tried to carve out that middle path. It didn't work. He couldn't find it. He was a brilliant military tactician and a deeply serious political actor, probably, in my opinion, the most serious political actor on the world stage at that point. And he was in an impossible dilemma. Once he was assassinated, you will recall, Hezbollah ceased its operations in defense of Gaza. It stopped. It realized there was no possibility of a middle path. And now, this time, it looked like the moment of truth for Iran. It was to live or to die. It was the moment of truth. Hezbollah elected the decision to die, to accept the total devastation because they knew a middle path was not possible. And that's where we're at now. Israel is now a madman. It's mad. It didn't get its way with Iran. And so it's flailing now. It's in a state of catatonic lunacy. I heard from friends this morning that Lebanon is being totally destroyed now. That's the madman. Israel's I've said it for many years, and it seems my view has now come has come to be the consensus. I said for many years, it's a lunatic state. It's a lunatic state. I came to that conclusion after spending a large part of my adult life reading the human rights reports in that country. But I have to make one qualification to what I just said. It's not just a lunatic state. It's a lunatic society. Very different. It's a completely lunatic society. The other day, the MIT professor, Ted Postal, he's an expert on ballistic missiles, anti-missile defense systems, very knowledgeable guy. He also happens to be, I understand, Jewish. And he described Netanyahu twice in the course of an interview as a homicidal maniac, because he thought Netanyahu was leading Israel to its complete destruction. He said, I wasn't aware of it, but he said that in fact Iran was very close to a nuclear weapon. It's not true that they're far away. They're very close. And he thought Israel would nuke Iran and Iran would retaliate. He said, Netanyahu is a homicidal maniac. But that's only one part of the story, in my opinion. It's the trivial part. It's a nation of homicidal maniacs. They're all homicidal maniacs. Look at the levels of support that they gave to the Israeli government during the genocide in Gaza. Only 5% of Israeli society throughout those 2.5 years, only 5% of Israeli Jewish society thought the government was using too much force. 40% of the Israeli Jewish society thought they weren't using enough force. Now, at least the Germans under the Nazi regime, they had the alibi. It was mostly fake. But they had the alibi. They didn't know that the final solution was occurring behind the walls of the concentration camps and death camps. They could say, we lived in a totalitarian country, and we had no alternative news, to use the expression from today. They wouldn't use that expression. Yeah, but they knew enough. You know, 50% of the Jews who were exterminated on the battlefield. They were lined up and shot down. That's how they were killed. 50% were killed in the death camps, in the concentration camps, but 50% were lined up and shot down. The soldiers knew. But Israel doesn't have even that alibi. In fact, they post on the social media what they're doing. Completely lunatic nation. So, it is going to be the destruction of Lebanon, because now it's the mad Israelis lashing out because they're mad, their homicidal maniac leader didn't get his way. So it's going to be tough for Lebanon. And I'm not going to in any way deny the anger of the Lebanese at the Hezbollah. They have a right to live. And they didn't want to sacrifice their lives for Iran. They didn't. They didn't want to sacrifice. I mean, the non-Hezbollah portion of the population. They didn't. And they have a right to not to want to. But on the other hand, the Hezbollah had a right, and you might say a responsibility, to come to the succor, S-U-C-C-O-R, which means the aid of a country that had come under assault by wild beasts, who then said they were going to end Iranian civilization.
Okay, no, and just a few more things I want to touch on before we let you go. So Iran's retaliation to this assault by what you say are the two beasts, which I completely, it's a very good metaphor. Their tactical assault was, you know, to respond towards Israel, but also then to hit U.S. assets in the region and also hit key economic assets in the GCC. Now, with hindsight, now that, you know, there's a, as you mentioned, there's a sort of a forced retreat from Trump because he realizes he may be losing, or was losing, not that there were any victors. But what do you make of that strategy? What's your thoughts on it?
Okay, let me start with the law, which I know fairly well. In 1996, and your viewers, I hope, will forgive me for making a historical reference that goes back more than a week. But in 1996, there was a historic advisory opinion by the International Court of Justice. The question was very simple. Is the threat or use of nuclear weapons legal under international law? Is the threat or use of nuclear weapons legal under international law? Now, for the sake of your viewers, let me just break it down very simply. I teach that decision. I teach international law, so I know it very well. And if you know a subject very well, you have the capacity for simplifying it. So every one of your listeners knows, viewers knows, that under international law, you're not allowed to fire, you're not allowed to indiscriminately bomb. That you have to only target military sites or combatants. You can't indiscriminately bomb everything. You have to spare civilians and civilian sites, civilian infrastructure. As every one of your listeners, viewers knows, a nuclear weapon can't discriminate. A nuclear weapon is inherently indiscriminate. So the question then is, can nuclear weapons be legal under international law because they don't have the capacity for discrimination? They will annihilate many times more civilians than they do combatants if it's used. And civilian infrastructure as against military sites. So the court deliberated over this question. And the final decision was as follows. The court said, under international law, most uses of nuclear weapons, most, are illegal. However, they said the following. If the survival of a state is at stake, in jeopardy, then it's not certain that the use of nuclear weapons is illegal. Now, my view is, if the International Court of Justice says, when the survival of a state is at stake, you have the right to use nuclear weapons that would maybe annihilate humanity because of the inevitable escalation. If you use them, the other nuclear power use them, and then it's terminal. But the ICJ said it's not certain that a state can't use them. In other words, it's possible they can use them. Iran's survival as a state was at stake. About that, I don't think anyone will disagree. It was clear the Israelis simply wanted Iran to disintegrate. They had no concern about the day after. Just wanted Iran to disintegrate as a state. So there are no obstacles to its control over the Middle East. The U.S. by the end was clear they wanted Iran, I mean, given what Trump was saying, to return it to the Stone Age to end Iranian civilization. Under those circumstances, Iran, it did target some civilian infrastructure. It did. I never quarrel with facts. In the Gulf states, it attacked bases, but it also targeted civilian infrastructure. A targeting some civilian infrastructure is way less than courting terminal nuclear war. And the ICJ said they may be allowed to use nuclear weapons. Iran did much less. So I think Iran was within its legal right, as defined by the ICJ, to engage in those targeted attacks on the Gulf states. Now, you might say, why the Gulf states? Well, here I'm going to be blunt with you. What do the Gulf states do for Gaza? What do they do for Gaza? Anything? So I say to the Gulf states, cry me a river. You hear me? Cry me a river. Do you know what the Gulf, the GCC did? The first action after the Israeli-American attack? You know what's the first thing they did? Go back and look at the headlines. They announced they were going to increase the availability of oil after the attack. Why? To facilitate the aggression by these wild beasts. If it increased the availability of oil to facilitate the U.S.-Israeli aggression, you know what? It could have reduced the availability of oil to support the people of Gaza. The godforsaken people of Gaza. It could have done something. It did nothing. What it did was it facilitated the U.S.-Israeli aggression against Iran. cry me a river.
Thanks, Norman. Two more things, if you have time, because I know that you've just kind of had the hour and we're almost there already. So the one is, you've mentioned, you know, that Trump has been you know, he's clearly ingratiated by himself, and you've touched on the fact that, you know, he has said things just before the ceasefire was announced. You said, you know, he will destroy Iranian civilization. They will not come back. He will send them to the Stone Age. There was also a tweet where he says praise to Allah. And he says, you know, Thursday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one, where he uses an expletive, open the fucking straits. In response to that tweet, someone who's been very anti-Trump, but was initially very close to him, Tucker Carlson, he said the following. He said, "Who do you think you are? You tweeted out the F word on Easter morning." And then he quotes Trump's tweet saying, "You'll be living in hell, as if though hell is a," and then he says, "as if though hell is a place, not a condition. And this is an example of that condition." And then he says to Trump, "You are not God, and only if you think you are, do you talk this way." Now, you've said, you know, similar damning things about Trump in this interview, but what do you think where do you think this leaves Trump's base? Do you think Tucker Carlson and the people who have been alongside him in sort of their criticism of Trump, specifically with how he seems to be, you know, allowing Israel to capture, or what they think is Israel capturing U.S. foreign policy? So people like Nick Fuentes, Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, do you think they sufficiently move Trump's base, or do you think they are also just elites within the Republican Party?
Judging by the polls, Trump's base has remained firm. It's a kind of cult, you can say, and a cult leader can do no wrong. We know that. I was a Maoist in my youth, a follower of Chairman Mao, and Chairman Mao could do no wrong. It's a cult. But I do believe, and I have to be careful about my language here because I don't want to be misunderstood. I do believe a problem is arising. You remember I told you a few moments ago, I said to you a few moments ago, that there was an informational void, which the Israelis filled. And there is a kind of political void in the United States. There are some exceptions, like Azora Mamdani's victory in New York, and the fact that Bernie Sanders can still bring out a crowd wherever he travels when he's attacking the Republican Trump administration. But in general, if you look, somebody sent me a diagram yesterday. It was a circle graph indicating who are the biggest podcasters now in the United States. The biggest was influencers. The biggest was Elon Musk. Then there were people like Jackson Hinkle. It's clear the left has no voice in the U.S. It's none. It doesn't have, at least on the social media, it has no real presence. The only person who ranked at all was Mehdi Hasan. And Mehdi Hasan is just an opportunist. You know, occasionally he'll say things that sound leftist, and then it's just Democratic Party lying. He's not a voice of the left. I don't even think he would call himself a person of the left. Now, the biggest institutional beneficiary of the debacle in Iran are going to be Tucker Carlson, Nick Fuentes, Candace Owens, all of whom said that this was going to be a disaster. You know, credit given where credit due. I have no problem with that. Tucker Carlson, not only when the war began, the aggression began, but already a month before, he apparently, judging from his what he said, he had visited the White House several times on several occasions and had strongly counseled against the war. And he said it would be a disaster. He was right, okay? And as you know the expression, to the victor go the spoils. His stock is now going to go through the ceiling. He's going to become a prophet. P-H-E-T, not F-I-T. He's going to become a prophet now, though he's going to profit F-I-T handsomely, for sure, from this. And I think That's a problem. Now, I don't want to question his religious convictions. I have no idea. I have to admit, and I'll get killed by people on the left for saying it, but what Tucker Carlson tweeted to Trump, that was kind of touching. It was. A person in power who actually cares about human life. Very unusual. So, I will credit that because I don't know whether to doubt his religious convictions or not. I don't know him. I spoke to him once, you know, on the phone for a while. Otherwise, I only know him via the web. However, giving credit where credit is due, this notion that this was an Israeli war, that the U.S. had no stake in it, that somehow the Israelis convinced Trump that Iran was our enemy. No, that went back about 30 years. Iran was our enemy. And if you listen to Tucker Carlson, he went one step further. He said Israel dragged the U.S. into the war because it wanted the U.S. to be defeated. It wanted to undermine the U.S. national security, U.S. military prowess, because Israel wanted to form an alliance with India. Now, honestly, I haven't a clue where that comes from. I really don't. And unfortunately, these ideas are now going to gain currency, because when you have a prophet, P-H-E-T, it's normal not normal. It's typical. I won't say normal. It's typical not to disaggregate their ideas. Like, okay, that was right. He was right about Iran. He was right about it. He was right about this too. And he was right about that too. But that's crazy. No, most people, it's a package. And, you know, you listen to these people, they're absolutely convinced that the Israelis killed John F. Kennedy. Yes, they all believe that. Next, you're going to be hearing that they assassinated Abraham Lincoln, that they caused the Civil War. No, I'm serious. You're laughing, but you have to see it, if you don't mind me saying so, you have to see it from my age and my perspective coming of age. I was alive during the Kennedy assassination. I remember it very well. I was in fifth grade. I remember the teacher announcing it with a tear in her eyes. Why do I mention this? Not to people, for your listeners to marvel at how old I am. No, I didn't know Abraham Lincoln, but I do remember JFK. I mention it for the following reason. From the day of Kennedy's assassination, everybody was fascinated by the question, who did it? Who did it? And there was this deluge, avalanche, of books written on the subject. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of books. The most famous was by a guy named Mark Lane. It was called Rush to Judgment. There was one by Harold Weisberg. Why do I know it? I was curious. I read all the books. Not all of them, but a lot of them. Everybody was fascinated by that question, because it seems so improbable that this one lone gunman, rather drab-looking Lee Harvey Oswald, had carried out this event of what was made out to be, it wasn't, but it was made out to be, of world historical significance, JFK's assassination. In fact, it was pretty much meaningless. Kennedy was in office for 3 years. Nobody can mention anything he did except for the fact that he brought the world to the verge, to the brink of nuclear annihilation. It was pretty close with Cuba and Russia in 1963. Other than that, there's nothing here, his record. But it was manufactured, this myth of what came to be called, your listeners will have no idea, but it was called the myth of Camelot. In any event, if you read those books, hundreds, maybe more than hundreds, nobody ever mentioned Israel. They mentioned organized crime. They mentioned Castro. They mentioned Russia. They mentioned, you know, various theories. Israel. You know what Israel was in 1963? Israel was a backwater. It had the GNP, or the GDP, however you calculate it, of an African country. It was very poor. It was very simple. It wasn't the subject of any conversation, least of all among American Jews. Israel? Kennedy? But that's what these people believe now. They believe that the United States is pristine. You know what pristine means? Pure. Pristine innocence. And that the Israelis control everything. They trick everybody. They're behind everything. Everything that happens. If there's a car crash on Ocean Parkway where I live, it's the Zionists, you know. It's true. I get the emails from perfectly sane people who are very adamant that Israel is behind everything. And now that voice, because they were right on Iran, is going to be vastly amplified. And that's a problem. It's a problem. It's going to be a very big problem for Jews, by the way. It's going to be a very big problem for Jews. And there is, you know, the Jews have historically always feared this charge of what's called dual loyalty. You know what dual loyalty means? It means that Jews are more loyal to other Jews than they are to their own country. The dual loyalty charge. And it has a very long pedigree, the claim of dual loyalty. And now when you hear these commentators, the question that constantly comes up is, who are they loyal to? Are they loyal to their country? Or are they loyal to another state? And if now it's being said that other state wanted to weaken the U.S., that's what Tucker Carlson says, then those people are guilty of treason. It's beyond dual loyalty. It's treason. You are aiding and abetting a foreign state to undermine the national security of your own country. That's treason. So it's going to be a rough ride now. You know the famous line by Betty Davis in All About Eve, fasten your seat belts. It's going to be a rough ride, a rough night. Yeah, there will be a problem for Jews. I'm not happy about that because I believe it's factually incorrect, a lot of the assumptions there. But in part, you have reaped what you have sown. You're going to reap the whirlwind now, and that's very regrettable, I believe. So there's going to be trouble, problems arising. Unfortunately, if you listen to I don't listen to the podcast, but I listened enough, the notion that it was what happened in Iran was, quote, it was Israel's war, Israel's doing. Everybody was saying it across the spectrum. You know, people, I don't think he's particularly bright, but the left doesn't have many bright lights anymore. The era of the great Noam Chomsky has passed, and now sub-mediocres are the left, with some exceptions, very few. But, you know, you hear people like Max Blumenthal, even this guy Daniel Levy, was just a left liberal, Israeli. They're all saying it was Israel. Yeah, Israel tipped the balance, but that the U.S. had no interest? The U.S. that had Iran in its crosshairs since 1979? The U.S. that approved Saddam Hussein's use of poison in its war against Iran? The U.S. which concealed Saddam Hussein's use of poison gas, concealed it, had no interest? No. It's way off.
Thank you, Norman. Final question, and I thank you again for your time. You may have or may have not seen this, but obviously we've seen over the last 2.5 years egregious reporting. Well, not 2.5 years. It's, I think, been exemplified in the last 2.5 years, but probably throughout your life you've seen very bad media reporting. There was a particularly terrible example from the BBC who quoted an anonymous source in Iran, and what they said was the following. Radin, that's the name of the anonymous source, also in his 20s and living in Tehran, said, and then they quote him saying, "About them hitting energy infrastructure, using an atomic bomb, or leveling Iran, my honest reaction is that I'm okay with all of these." A few moments later, the BBC article corrected itself to say, Radin, also in his 20s and living in Tehran, said, "If attacking targets in the country brings down the Islamic Republic, I'm fine with that. Because if the Islamic Republic survives through this war, it will stay forever." Now, I mean, there's so many questions here, whether Radin exists. Why would they fabricate this quote? A level of dehumanization where people want to, you know, dehumanize themselves so much that they're willing to endure an atomic bomb. Just what's your reaction to that?
My reaction is there obviously was a large number of people in Iran who wanted to see the regime overthrown, just as I said, in the Soviet Union. So at some point in time, somebody may have said that. And I didn't know. I was asking people constantly, what do you think? Will the support for the regime collapse now? Will they try to overthrow it? Will they support it? And as I said to you at the very beginning, the people I know who are the most knowledgeable, they threw up their hands and they shrugged their shoulders. Nobody knew. But it was clear from the pretty much the beginning, the huge crowds that came out, there was a lot of support. But even if a crowd in a nation of 90 million, even if the crowd in the streets is 1 million, you don't really know whether that's all the support or whether it's representative of the support. What clearly happened, and a friend of mine wrote me yesterday because I was sending him the most knowledgeable person I know in Iran, his name is Evan Siegel, and I would like to publicly acknowledge him. The most knowledgeable person I know, I was sending him my correspondence with my friend in Iran, and he wrote back to me and he said, well, it's clear Trump and Netanyahu succeeded in uniting the people of Iran around the regime, exactly what happened with the Stalin regime. You know, by the World War II, the middle of World War II, you know what they called Stalin? The Little Father. The Little Father. The Nazis, because if they hadn't engaged in the war of extermination, the Russians probably would have been defeated. But, and it's the same thing, I think, you know, had the Trump regime been more discriminating, there was a chance the people would rebel. Hard to say. I don't know for sure, but my friends who are totally fluent in Farsi, who are Iranian, they said it was possible. They didn't know. But it was the way it was carried out. It was carried out because they are. I agree with Dr. Postol. They are homicidal maniacs. Trump is just an ape. I mean, you know, I have had occasion to read presidential papers. That's the collection of memos, speeches, everything. In general, they're of a very high quality. Could you imagine assuming the planet survives? Which is a question mark. Assuming the planet survives, could you imagine students reading Trump's presidential papers? First of all, it consists 90% of tweets. It is. It's true. He's not capable of a paper. His speeches, the speech he gave at Davos that lasted 2.5 days, you know, it's really kind of breathtaking what's happened. So they succeeded. Their one success was to unite the Iranian people with the regime.
What's your comment, though, on the fact that there was a quote that said about them hitting energy infrastructure, using an atomic bomb or leveling Iran? My honest reaction to that is I'm okay with all of these. So they quoted initially an Iranian who would say that.
I would say that's very implausible. Let's put it that way. I have to say, though, credit where credit is due, even though it's very little credit, I was kind of struck at the prime minister's name, Starmer, but in my little clique, we call him Der Stürmer, which is the... I was quite struck by Der Stürmer's audacity in defying Trump. My goodness, there's no question you're not using our bases. And he repeated the thing. So that was, and you know, a few days before, Macron came out and said the guy ought to shut up already. And if he's going to speak a sentence, he shouldn't be contradicting himself in each sentence. It was like the Europeans, they've reached the point of fed up with this guy. They're tired of defending a retarded ape. So I come from a family of people who suffered terribly during World War II, so you can't laugh about war. It's not permissible for me, because it would be desecrating the memory of my family. Not just those who died, but those who lived, to joke about it. But there were some silver linings. No, I take that back. There's never a silver lining in a war. But I'm glad some things were revealed. Let's just put it that way, about the nature of this system, the nature of the sycophants, the lickspittles, the grovelers before power, you know. So pathetic, so pitiful to watch them. Hail the chief.
Norman Finkelstein, thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you.